JC Corcoran Podcast.
When a man meets the woman he loves, everything changes. His heart races, his head spins. And suddenly, all the dozens and dozens of women he's sleeping with no longer matter. A few years ago, I found the woman I love, and I've put some of my feelings into this little ode. Every man needs a woman, and I need you. To lift me when I am sad, to comfort me when I am down, to clean me when I am drunk, to walk beside me when I want to look like I am not gay. To walk in front of me when I need someone to act as a human windbreak. To kiss me when I am horny. To massage me when I am tense and or horny. To make me horny when I am not horny. And then to watch me fall asleep. I need you, darling, to clean between my toes when they are not clean to my satisfaction. To pick the nits out of my hair when I have head lice. To try milk for me when I am not sure of the expiration date. To be there when I need you to be there, and to be out of town the rest of the time. My darling, although it may seem sentimental, I want to take this moment to tell you I love you, because I don't want to lose half my stuff. Good night, my love.
Now I'm just getting warmed up.
Happy to see you again.
Don't be nervous. Don't be rocky. You're a teenage guest as jockey now.
And let me begin by wishing you a beautiful look.
Did that voice inside you say, I've heard it all before? It's like deja vu all over again.
Wednesday, November 3rd, we're going to get a freeze across the Midwest and in St. Louis. Overnight, tonight into tomorrow. How you doing, kids? JC, JCOnTheLine.com. We're here every weekday morning, and we post about 7 o'clock, and we just sort of do our thing. Well, you know, I've been trying to tell jokes my entire life. When you start out very young, you steal jokes. You know, you sit there and listen to Johnny Carson's monologue, and you write down the really funny jokes, and you try to tell them at school the next day because you assume that nobody else saw it but you, and somebody else was up late, and they start going, Johnny Carson told that joke last night. And then you realize, I better get some better jokes. And so you start stealing jokes from more remote sources that can't be traced. You pass these things off as your own. And then it's like anything else, as you begin to grow a little bit older, you start writing your own jokes and you start deciding whether or not you're really funny enough to actually do this, to walk around and try to make people laugh. And then somebody says, we will pay you to tell occasional jokes on the radio. And so you do that. And you do that for, in my case, you know, a number of decades. And you reach a point where you start wanting more. And so in my particular case, I've been fortunate enough to hang out with a couple of comedy writers, as you know, from St. Louis University High School. A guy who wrote for, David Letterman, Jon Stewart, Bill Maher, and eventually 14 years as Conan O'Brien's monologue writer. Hi, Chris. And he listens once in a while in New Jersey. And, so you're sitting there and you're like, okay, well, I reached a level of proficiency at that. Not only am I writing my own material, not only am I telling my own jokes, I'm hanging out with other people who do this, you know, professionally. And it's exciting. It's like anything else. Back in the day, if you were a big bowler and you ran into Dick Weber, I mean, that would have been a big deal, right? If you love playing basketball and you're in an airport, you run into Charles Barkley, you know, pretty good chance you're going to bug the guy for a selfie. So it's like anything else. You start by doing something you sort of like, and then you start to become really, really good at it. And you find out, like, again, like anything else, that there's a technique and there's a right way or a wrong way to do things, to write a joke. You find out about the kind of material that would be welcome by comedians, and you find out the kind of material that would sort of laugh at you because the jokes were very amateur. You know, right way and a wrong way to do everything, right? And again, I hate to keep saying this, but it is true. Again, like everything else, you start realizing that there is almost a science to this, and you're trying to pick up what you can. Really, you go back and you find out that David Letterman didn't like prop comics, meaning that if you had to bring something out on stage with you to be able to do your comedy, that would not be the kind of thing that Letterman would have put on the show. It's why Gallagher, you know, smashing watermelons, was going to be on that show. There was a guy I remember who used to juggle chainsaws, and the chainsaws were running. And come to think of it, I seem to remember Letterman having him on maybe once. My brain could be playing tricks on me here because, again, he didn't like prop comics. You find out that if you're writing jokes and submitting them to a comedian, the last thing you want to do is have like a bunch of exclamation points at the end of the joke, you know, at the end of the punchline. They're sort of like, you know, amateur comedy writers all over the country, and they're always submitting their material to comedians, hoping that they can get a couple of bucks and also be able to say, hey, you know, Frank Caliendo is doing a joke I gave him. That's actually kind of funny, come to think of it, because I gave Frank Caliendo a joke once, and he did use it. It wasn't even a joke. It was just an observation. Back when W was president, the way he would stand, he always looked like he was ready to draw. And I made that comment during an interview we had with him on the air, and he sort of stopped, and he looked at me, he said, I might have to steal that. And I said, go ahead. John Hughes, the movie director of, you know, Ferris Bueller's Day Off and The Breakfast Club and all that stuff, he used to write jokes for Rodney Dangerfield. A lot of comedians wrote jokes for Rodney Dangerfield. One of my prized possessions is a sheet of paper with all of the jokes that were submitted for David Letterman in his final monologue. And you see the notes written in the corner. I should actually put that up on Facebook one of these days because it's really cool. There's writing all over it and everything, you know, as they changed the way the joke was going to be set up and then delivered and all that sort of stuff. And all, it's really, really cool to have that. Now, you know, you've been saying, JC, you've talked for almost 10 minutes here. Where are you going with all this? Where are you going? What's the point of all this? I set this up because we may be seeing the slow, painful death of comedy in this country, and here's why. You could put the 20 funniest comedy writers and or performers in a room and say, all right, we want you to come up with the most bizarre scenarios for jokes, and then we'll come back in a couple of hours and see what you guys came up with. And they would never come up with anything this bizarre because people would say, well, can you write a joke that maybe is a little more real? Because what you gave us is so out there, it could never happen. So that diminishes the effect of the joke. So when we said bizarre scenarios, we meant and everything like that. But what you're doing is just, it's too out there. For a joke to work, people have got to sort of believe in the setup. You got to buy the premise. Well, as we speak, and this is where I'm going with all this, as we speak, there's dozens, perhaps hundreds, I'm not really sure what it looks like this morning, people waiting in Dealey Plaza. If you are unfamiliar with that term, that is the place where John F. Kennedy was assassinated back in 1962. I got that off my bucket list, by the way, when I lived in Houston there for about a year and a half. And we took the tour, and you go up to the fourth floor, and there's like a museum and a presentation and the whole thing. And you get to look out the window where Lee Harvey Oswald was. And you look down and you realize really how close it is. And then Dealey Plaza, you know, that grassy knoll, which has the white fence at the sort of back of that whole thing. I don't even think that's 90 feet from where the president's car was, where the limousine was. You know, on television and on film, it looks like the length of a football field. And then you go and you stand there and you're like, man, oh man, hand me a quarter. I could whip a quarter out there into traffic and probably hit the car going by. Not that that's what happened or anything. I'm just saying that the whole thing was, I have my own theories on what happened to JFK. And maybe we'll talk about that somewhere down the line as the anniversary comes up here in a couple of weeks. So as we speak, right there in Dealey Plaza, the site of the JFK assassination. QAnon followers are waiting for the arrival of both John Fitzgerald Kennedy, who was assassinated in 1962, and JFK Jr., who died in that plane crash off of Martha's Vineyard. What was that, like 12 years ago? Oh, no, it gets better. Not only did the government fake both of their deaths, according to QAnon, but both of them are going to come out of seclusion, show up at Dealey Plaza, and are you ready? Because I'm not even done with this. They're just going to reemerge, get on a microphone somewhere and go, hey, it's great to be back. And by the way, we're not exactly sure. We haven't worked out all the details yet. But one of the two of us is going to be Donald Trump's running mate in 2024. You think I'm making this up? I'm not. Forget the fact that JFK and JFK Jr. were two of the most democratic Democrats in the history of politics. So again, to review, hundreds of people waiting at Dealey Plaza, the site of the JFK assassination, waiting for the reemergence of JFK and JFK Jr., who are then going to surprise everyone. Of course, you won't be surprised, though, because I told you all about this ahead of time. They're going to go up there and go, one of the two of us is going to be Donald Trump's running mate, even though we're both Democrats. I've belonged to organizations in the past. You know, one of the things about belonging to an organization is like everybody is on the same page. You all have the same interests. You know, I would even count like baseball teams as groups because you're there as much for the social interaction as you are for playing the game. That's why softball teams go play, you know, softball and then go out to a bar afterwards because of the camaraderie. I mean, that's part of the whole deal. And I belonged to teams and organizations before where everything seems to be going along just, you know, swimmingly. And then, you know, they start making rules or somebody says something or some guy you don't like starts, you know, throwing his weight around. And you're like, you know what? This is bullshit. I don't want to be part of this team or part of this organization anymore. What would the QAnon people have to cook up before at least some of their followers would begin to flake off? Because even they reached the point where they're like, all right, this is getting a little too crazy here. Some guy had his head blown apart 60 years ago. Well, and again, you know, obviously they don't accept that. They don't accept that. I don't know who was in the car that day. I don't know who was in all those autopsy pictures with half of his head gone. I don't know who that guy was, but he wasn't JFK. Because JFK is coming back and he's on our side. So when you start getting stuff like that happening in real life, you know how difficult it is now to do comedy after that? Because you already heard the goofiest thing you're going to hear all year. How do you write jokes now? I told you yesterday on the podcast the Democrats were going to lose in Virginia, and they did big time. And they almost, well, they still may end up losing the New Jersey gubernatorial thing too, which was supposed to be a runaway for the Democratic candidate. I didn't see that one coming, but I told you that the Republicans were going to win Virginia. I still live right across the river from Virginia. Let me tell you, it's not really what you would call a progressive state, okay? I have no idea how they ended up with the Democrat in there in the first place. And just exactly what is motivating people to vote? Like they always say, it depends on turnout. It depends who actually bothers to show up. And I think there's an automatic assumption, I guess you would say, that people who vote, you know, particularly in off-year elections like we just had yesterday, are the more, I guess you would say, passionate people, people who are much more educated about the positions the candidates hold. They follow politics fairly closely. And if asked about it, they can verbalize their opinions and express why they chose one candidate over another. Right?
What's the most important issue in the governor's race here in Virginia?
Getting back to the basics of teaching children, not teaching them critical race theory.
And what is critical race theory?
Well, I'm not going to get into the specifics of it because I don't understand it that much, but it's something that I don't, what little bit that I know, I don't care for.
And what have you heard that you don't,
well,
that you
I'm
don't
not,
like?
Well, I'm not going to, you know, I don't have that much knowledge on it, but okay. It's something that I don't care for.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is what we are up against. I don't know what it is, but I hate it. Well, can you tell me just a little bit about it? No, but I showed up today to vote against it. If you follow me on Facebook, The Show Grind with J.C. Corcoran, you already know that I'm sitting here this morning with a broken toe. And I've never broken a toe before, and I didn't know that there's nothing that you can do. You just walk around with it with a limp, and it's very painful. And everybody was like, oh, I've done that, and it hurts. And it's like, wow, yes, you're right, it does. It was just general clumsiness on my part, but you ought to see the pretty colors. Back to entertainment here for a minute. I've had the pleasure of speaking one-on-one in person with Denzel Washington on a number of occasions. He's a very cool guy. Smart as they come. Very personable. Damn good-looking guy. Loves a good laugh. You know, I've interviewed people where you walk into the room and they have this look on their face like, so you're the next fucking idiot I have to sit here with. And you can just tell from even before you walk in, they just don't have the right attitude. And that comes through on the camera. And it's like, sometimes I want to just say, why did you even bother? Why didn't you just blow it off? But they're all contractually obligated to show up for these things. And somehow they just, you know, hate the entire process. And so you sit there and it's like pulling molars out of somebody's head. But there are people you walk in, like Kim Basinger, I always used to talk about. You know, got a chance to meet her and interview her one-on-one pretty much back in the 80s, early 90s, and just so much fun. I played that thing the other day, as a matter of fact, about her and her family being in the bomb shelter. And if you missed that story, go back. I think it was maybe from 2 days ago. It's so funny. And Denzel Washington was one of those guys. You come walking in the room, and he's very upbeat. If you said something really funny, he would laugh really, really hard, and then he'd sort of play around with you a little bit. And this is what you want, because you don't want somebody to say, tell me about the movie, please. Well, the movie starts here, and it goes here, and it ends there. Thank you. Who the hell wants to hear that? You want to see, I guess what I'm saying is, you want to see these actors act like people. I've said it before, I'll say it again a million times, I'm sure. One of the ways of communicating with celebrities in a way that produces really, really funny, entertaining results is to treat them like, what I do is I always treat them like who they were before they became famous. Because otherwise you'll get eaten alive. There was that one period there where I had John Travolta, I had Dustin Hoffman. I'm trying to remember who the other person was. It was really, really huge. Oh, Kevin Costner. And in all cases, I just sort of went in there, and in my mind, they were not big-time famous celebrities. It was Kevin, and it was John, and it was Dustin. All of these people were just people before they became famous, and that's how I always treat them. And I always remember when I would come back from California after having seen a Denzel Washington movie and then interviewing him, all the black ladies in the newsroom would always come over to my desk. They wouldn't normally have much to say to me, but they knew that I had just been in the presence of Denzel Washington, and they all came over and like they wanted to know, okay, we heard you were there. What happened? Tell us, you know, blah, blah, blah. I thought it was the cutest thing ever. Well, now, after what? We've been watching Denzel Washington movies for what? 40 years? 35 years? Whatever it is. It turns out now, his name is Denzel. It's not Denzel. It's Denzel. And I'm like, what? And here's the story. Denzel's father's name was also Denzel. So his mother would yell, hey, Denzel! And two people would show up, the father and also what we came to know as Denzel. And that's what she did. She figured, okay, here's what we're going to do. Dad, you remain Denzel. Son, you're now Denzel. So I can, you know, so when I call somebody's name here, I know who's showing up. I don't need both of you, which I guess makes sense. Then you start thinking about George Foreman, who had, what, 5 or 6 sons, all of them named George. There are some things in the world that we apparently are not meant to understand. All right, on this date in the year 2000, maybe that Conan O'Brien bit, in the year 2000, it was I'm Still with Mel. After Mel's plane went down, that would be Carnahan, by the way, the big concert at the Pageant, and Kevin Kline was there. Sheryl Crow was there, and not just there, but performing. I mean, Sheryl Crow did probably an hour set, and I still have the master recording of that. I was plugged directly into the soundboard. And also Don Henley was there, but even somebody like me, a really, really serious Don Henley fan. I love his solo work in addition to all of his work with the Eagles. But that night, you want to talk about something misguided. You know, Sheryl Crow was really, really good. Kevin Kline was really, really funny. And then Don Henley comes out, and he doesn't do any songs that anybody knows. He doesn't do any Eagles songs. He doesn't do any Don Henley songs. He's up there doing, like, Irish folk chants. And people were like, what are you doing? And the crowd there at the pageant started getting louder and louder and louder. And pretty soon, nobody was paying any attention to what Don Henley was singing. Everybody had just broken down into small discussion groups. I guess they figured, you know, maybe this will be over soon. But it wasn't. It went on forever. And it was bad. 1989, on this date, I was in Southern California interviewing people like Dolly Parton and Julia Roberts for a movie called Steel Magnolias. I had never met Dolly Parton before. I walked in the room, sat down, and was blown away by her beauty. I would say she's probably, you know, one of the top 5 or 10 best-looking women that I've ever been in the presence of. And the thing about it was her skin. I think she was in her mid-40s at the time, and it didn't even look like human skin. It looked like some sort of dairy product or something. It was like butter! And she was very, very friendly, very, very nice, and very, very, very pretty. Steel Magnolias. And then on this date, 1997, I found myself in St. Louis City Court because about not quite 2 years prior to that event in 1997, two stool samples who went by the on-air name of Stephen D.C., well, I had to sue them. And the trial began on this date in 1997, went 6 days, which is really, really long for a case like this. At the end, the jury, I was told by one of the jurors, well, this was like a year later, a guy who actually works at Schnucks in this customer service department, and the one next to the Esquire. And I walked in there one day, and we just recognized each other immediately. It's like, you were on the jury. He's like, yeah. I was like, well, you know, let's talk about this a minute. Just tell me what was going on in that jury. He says, well, we wanted to give you $1 million, but there was this one woman on the jury who looked like she was about 60 years old, and she had really long, unkempt, stringy, grayish hair and wore a Keishi t-shirt to the trial every day. And she hated me. But just to show you how strong my case was, she hated me and still voted in my favor. And so the number they came up with was $360,000 in damages. 24 years ago today. Things are tough in Chicago. My hometown has fallen upon hard times. And I don't need to tell you about all the shootings that go on there. And now a threshold seems to be, well, seems to have been crossed. The story is a female Chicago police officer had to shoot somebody the other night. Another cop. The cops are now shooting each other. And my voice is starting to act up a little bit here again, so I'm going to probably have to cut this maybe 5 minutes short here today. I'm still suffering the effects of the surgery from, well, it was 2 weeks ago today, as a matter of fact. 8 inches of snow on the ground in northern Michigan today. Guardian Angels founder Curtis Sliwa went to vote yesterday in the New York mayoral election and brought his cat. Election officials said, you can't bring that cat in here. And he started shouting, arrest me. Josh Hawley issued a statement yesterday that he believes women's liberation is driving otherwise good men to the world of pornography. Who's going to tell him that the guys are already there? Regardless of what the women are doing, this guy just cracks me up. He just absolutely cracks me up. We have another crooked preacher. You can look on my Facebook page, The Showgram with J.C. Corcoran, another one of these guys who was bilking, you know, his parishioners out of hundreds of thousands of dollars, and he will now go away for the rest of his life. And over the weekend at a Halloween party in Dallas, where the theme of the party was, come as your favorite bad guy, a guy showed up dressed as David Freeze. See, now, I think that's funny. And if you're a Texas Rangers fan, it still hurts, I'm sure. So why not? Semi-brilliant, folks. Semi-brilliant. And also, congratulations to Braves manager Brian Snitker, the pride of Macon, Illinois, up near, sort of like Decatur, right in there. He wins it all last night, and the baseball season is now officially over, and we wait till next spring. At some point here, the bad news should be coming that the forces that be at MLB are going to force the designated hitter on the National League. Terrible move. We don't want it. They're going to do it anyhow. They don't care. And on that happy note, we say thanks for listening to the J.C. Corcoran Podcast here at jconline.com. We publish, I'm late today, I apologize. We publish at about 7 o'clock, give or take 20 minutes. And it's all free. It's all free. If you miss a podcast, don't worry. We archive them all right here and on various platforms. Email me at jc@jconline.com. On Facebook, the Showgram with J.C. Corcoran. We thank our technical wizard, Everett Marshall, for all of his effort in this whole thing. We'll talk again in the morning. In the meantime, we beat this one to death. Have a good one. See you later. Bye.
The J.C. Corcoran Podcast.